Welcome back to Monsters and Mixers podcast. We are your hosts. I am Emma.
And I am Amy.
Thank you for joining us again another week.
It's a really special week, though, because it's actually our one-year anniversary tomorrow, so our podiversary.
On Monday, probably when a lot of you are going to be listening to this, so thank you all very much for getting us here. It's been a fun ride.
Yeah, really exciting. I was trying to think earlier today about what it felt like a year ago. When we started, and I just remember being like super excited, and I'm still super excited every day.
It was very different. We like printed everything out and sat in our kitchen, and
yeah, we've evolved a little bit. But I mean, I thought our first episode was pretty good.
Oh yeah, I agree.
If you haven't listened to it, it's the Lollary Mansion, and it's really super scary. So
it's crazy. It does not feel like a year.
No,
I don't know what episode number is this. Do you
like 34, maybe 34, 35?
I can't see.
If you click on the last one, it'll tell you what episode number that was. It's been I think it's 35.
It does not tell me.
No?
It just says season 2, episode 9. But that sounds about right.
Yeah, I think so. So anyway, thank you if you have been sticking with us through all of it. This is number 34. It's been really fun for us, and we are going to bring you more and more and more. So
We got a lot coming.
Yep.
A lot of ground to cover.
All right, today is a BYOB episode brought to you by Emma. So she's going to go ahead and get started and tell us her tale.
All right, so today I'm going to be diving into another missing persons case. And this one was actually recommended to us to cover by a friend of the show. Shout out Abby if she's listening.
Hi, Abby.
Different Abby than Ouija Abby, but there's a lot of Abbys in my life.
Abby's everywhere.
And that is the strange disappearance of Jennifer Kess.
So neat. Poor people disappearing.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of women, I have noticed.
Yeah.
Young women. Jennifer Joyce Kess was born May 20th, 1981, and she abruptly disappeared from Orlando, Florida, towards the beginning of 2006. Only 24 years at the time, Jennifer was a graduate of Vivian Gaither High School and had also just graduated from University of Central Florida in 2003 with a degree in finance. Growing up in Tampa, her parents described Jennifer as a super smart child from an early age. Her mom said that she was speaking in like full sentences at only a year old, which is
pretty advanced for a one-year-old.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah.
It said that everyone enjoyed being around Jennifer, and she was a very well-liked person growing up. All of this spilled into her studies as well, and all of her teachers were very fond of her. She got good grades, she was incredibly involved in activities at school and around her community, and she was just an overall great kid. She loved to read and learn about anything new.
So that seems to be another pattern for a lot of these missing persons.
Yeah.
They're really capable, smart, active people.
Mm-hmm. She had a very close relationship with her parents that seemed to become even closer when she was in her college years. Jennifer's mom remembers that she went away for school, and when she came back, they almost immediately had like this adult relationship, this adult friendship. And you and I can definitely attest to this. I went away to school for 2 years, and when I came back to visit, our relationship definitely felt closer than it did when I left. It's just a different dynamic.
Yeah. It's a really nice thing as a parent to be able to stop parenting and just be a friend. I mean, it's my job when you guys were growing up to get you ready to be an adult, and it's really nice now that you guys are all adults, mm-hmm. and we can have that different relationship. Not that you don't need me as a parent sometimes too, but right. It's just a different dichotomy now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think just leaving home and being away for extended periods of time really matures the personal relationships you have back home, whether it be friends or family. All of them grow up pretty fast.
I agree completely.
So Jessica was offered several jobs when she graduated, which is the dream for almost every recent college grad. Her degree in finance was paying off, and she was able to enter her career almost immediately. She decided to accept a position at a timeshare company called Westgate Resorts in, I believe it's, I've tried so hard to pronounce this, Ocoee, I'm not sure, somewhere in Florida.
Okochee.
That was very close to Orlando, and she loved it. Her coworkers loved to work with her, and she really excelled and flourished in her position as a finance and project major, and it said that she even got 3 promotions in just her first year of being there, which is amazing and really just shows how well she was doing in this environment. She had also recently just purchased her own condo in Orlando, which is a super big deal at her age, and she was very proud of it, as she should have been. It is a very nice condo. It was brand new.
Okay, I'm going to have to stop you for a sec. Is her name Jessica or Jennifer? Because you just call her Jessica.
Did I call her Jessica? Yeah. Jennifer. I'm sorry. Jennifer.
Okay, just want to make sure I wasn't wrong.
Did not mean to do that. At the time, she was in a long-distance relationship with her boyfriend, Rob Allen, whom her mother says she was absolutely in love with. Although Rob lived 3 hours away in Fort Lauderdale, the two would make sure they saw each other every weekend, which is incredibly important given the distance between the two. Long-distance relationships are difficult, but Rob and Jennifer were set on making theirs work. Rob and Jennifer took a trip to St. Croix 1 week before Jennifer disappeared. They were said to have had a great time in a beautiful place together, and they returned home that Sunday night. Rob is quoted saying, "My best friend said to me after the trip, 'Oh, you're in love and you just don't want to admit it.' The two of them were seemingly on cloud nine."
No.
When Jennifer was gone, her brother Logan was going to use her condo as a place to stay. Logan invited a few friends over, Travis, who was his best friend, and Matt, who was also his friend and Jennifer's ex-boyfriend.
Uh-oh.
Which is a little weird, but I mean...
Well, I mean, a lot of people can still be friends with their exes. It doesn't
Well, Jennifer have to be a weird and thing. Matt were not friends.
Okay.
Logan was friends with Matt, but I'm going to assume that Logan and Matt were friends prior to Jennifer's relationship
Maybe.
With Matt. During this time, Travis accidentally left his phone at Jennifer's place. So, that Sunday, when they returned after a canceled flight on Saturday, Jennifer decided it'd just be easier to stay at Rob's that night and wake up super early the next morning to drive back to Orlando directly to work, which she did. That Monday, January 3rd, Jennifer called her mom on her way into work. Her mother, Joyce, said, "Jen shared every detail about the trip. She was on a cloud." Jennifer had a relaxing night planned as she was still pretty tired from her trip. We all know the post-vacation yeah. wind down. And she was just going to hang out at home by herself and de-stress to prepare for her work week. That afternoon, Jennifer had a meeting with her boss at 6 p.m. before she drove straight home. Tollbooth surveillance cameras confirmed that she took her usual route back to her condo. Once she returned home, she made a call to her best friend, Lauren, to once again discuss the details of her trip. Lauren said that Jennifer was in a little bit of a funky mood, but she just blamed it on it being the end of a vacation. You know, when you're like riding that high still and you just want to word vomit everything out to everybody.
And she probably has a little post-vacation depression.
Yeah.
Have something really awesome happen, then you're just like, it's mm-hmm. over, I'm sad.
But Lauren also said that she thought the distance was becoming more apparent to her in her relationship, given the conversation that they had.
In her relationship with
Rob.
Rob? Okay.
Later that evening, Jennifer would also make separate phone calls to her father and her brother Logan. Her father, Drew, said she absolutely loved the trip and that everything was absolutely fine when he talked to her. During her call with Logan, he informed her that Travis left his phone at her place, and she told him that she would mail it out to him from her work mail room the next day because she had access to a UPS on site. So, that night, Jennifer also made a phone call to her boyfriend, Rob. Things get a little convoluted here. Some sources claim that Rob and Jennifer got into a disagreement. Some don't mention it at all, but Rob himself has verified that they did get into a little argument during their phone call. The last known call Jennifer made was to Rob from her landline, as she was said to not get great cell service inside of her condo. According to multiple sources, Rob, who has not been named a person of interest, I want to say that now, said they did have a disagreement on the phone that night, but he claims the disagreement was like, quote, any husband, wife, boyfriend, any couple might have. But CBS News reports that Allen would later claim that their fight was indeed about the strain long distance was putting on their relationship. During an interview with CNN, Rob said Jennifer was in bed when they were talking on the phone, and that she expressed to him that she was still tired from vacation and her day at work, and he also noted that someone knocked on her door during their phone call. Rob claims that Jennifer figured the knock on her door was from a male upstairs neighbor of hers, but she did not answer the door.
Okay.
It's also important to note that Jennifer's phone was turned off sometime between when she ended her calls with people and when she woke up the next morning. Not only was it turned off, but the battery was also removed.
Which is weird, because why would you not charge your cell phone?
Right, and I'm almost wondering if maybe the disagreement that she had with Rob upset her and she just didn't really want to talk to anybody. I'm not sure. She made her phone call rounds. I mean, this was a different time period, 2006. So
and she had a landline.
And so people aren't, like, texting constantly. And she could also communicate with people, like, get phone calls through her computer at this time. So it's not like she was cutting herself out to the world.
Right.
She also powered off Travis's phone that was left in her home and took out the battery, but that was normal. She was supposed to send it back the next day, and that's what you do when you send back a cell phone.
Oh, you have to take battery after you ship a cell phone?
Mm-hmm. Huh. An old school cell phone. Probably not an iPhone, but...
I was going to say, I'm not sure I've ever done that, but We can't even remove a battery from an iPhone. Yeah.
I think you can only remove the SIM card of an iPhone. But old school, yeah, I would say so, just in case the battery explodes. No one knows to this day why her phone was turned off. The next morning, January 24th, 2006, Jennifer did not report to work as she usually did, which was incredibly out of the ordinary for her. According to her mother, Jennifer would have typically left her home between 7:30 and 8 a.m. to walk to her car in the parking lot and begin her drive to work. In other places, such as findjenniferkess.com, her parents narrow this time down further to usually around 7:30 to 7:45 each workday. Joyce Kess says that no one on the ground floor condos near where Jennifer's car was parked heard a scream or disturbance that morning.
Was her car still there?
We will get to that.
Okay.
Her mother also says that she was in the habit of calling Rob right when she got into her car, which she did not do this morning. Rob was running late and called her later on for their typical pre-work talk, but he just got her voicemail, which was once again unusual. It's unclear if this call went straight to voicemail or if it rang until it went to voicemail, because both one of them would indicate that her phone was still shut down. The other one would indicate that her phone is on.
Right.
In his interview with CNN, Rob says, "Jennifer always woke up before me. She had to go to work before I did. She every day would either call me just to say good morning, have a great day, or just text me to wish me to, you know, have a great day. Love you, that type of thing. And when I didn't receive it Tuesday morning, I thought it was odd, but I was running a little late for work, so I called her on the way into work and just got her voicemail." Jennifer had a meeting planned for 11 a.m. that morning at work, and her boss knew that there would be no way that she would just not show up for it, so they gave her a call and got no answer. Getting increasingly worried, this is a great boss, by the way.
Yeah.
The fact that they're going above and beyond for this. Her boss then contacted her parents, as they were listed as her emergency contacts. The second her parents found out about this, they knew there was no way Jennifer would just not show up to work. So they tried calling her too and got no answer. This time, it's reported that the phone didn't even ring. It went straight to voicemail. Her parents knew that something was seriously wrong. This was completely out of character for her. Jennifer's mother called her landline in her condo, her cell phone, and her computer, and was unable to reach her on any of them. It was at this point that Joyce and Drew called Rob to let him know that Jennifer didn't show up to work and they couldn't get a hold of her. He told them that he also hadn't heard from her either, and said that he also thought it was odd of her to not call or text him as she usually did. Jennifer was a very routine person who did virtually the same thing every morning, so for her to not do what she'd done for a year now raised immediate red flags to everyone close to her.
Yeah, as it should. It sounds
really
strange just to, after you just got done, because you know how it is when you get into a fight even. Like the next day you wake up, your cooler heads have prevailed. That would be the first thing. She would be like, hey, sorry about that.
Yeah, and it doesn't even seem like a fuck you type of fight. It was more of like a disagreement that they had, where I'm sure she was probably like, how far away you are from me is really weighing on our relationship. Maybe we should look to move you closer to me. Because I'm pretty sure they met at a bar, and I don't know if he was currently ex-military or was still in the military, but I think he was ex-military, so that would have given him a lot of flexibility to move. I'm not sure what his, like, situation was. So I don't think it was, like, a screaming match fight. They were still together. They didn't break up on the phone.
Well, even after having just been on vacation with someone, you realize how much you enjoy their company and being with them every day. So I'm sure she was sad about having to go back to the routine of not seeing him all the time.
Yeah, I can attest.
Yeah.
That. I agree. Her parents noted that her phone going straight to voicemail was particularly odd because Jennifer was very cautious and keen on safety. Her parents had instilled that in their children because apparently before they were born, her parents were, like, held up at gunpoint, which, like, shook them to their core as it would anybody. So in raising them, they instilled, like, this vigilance and safety and being, you know. And Jennifer took that to heart and grew up that way and kept it with her. She would always call someone when she was walking alone, either walking to her car or if she was just feeling unsure about her surroundings. So her phone being off really made no sense. The family tried to get a hold of her for over an hour before finally deciding to just drive to her condo, which was about 2 hours away from where they lived.
Which is what I would have done too.
Yeah. On their way there, they called the condo complex and asked them to go check to see if Jennifer's black Chevy Malibu was still in the parking lot. It was also nowhere to be found. When her parents got to her place and got inside, they said that everything looked completely normal, and the only things missing were her cell phone, keys, and purse, which are all normal things you'd expect someone to take with them when they leave for the day or just leave in general. As they were looking around, they noticed that a bottle of pepper spray was sitting on her counter, She typically kept this right next to her car keys and always grabbed both before heading out, so it concerned them that she took one but not the other.
Yeah, that's weird.
Clothes were laid out on her bed, and there was still water in her shower and a damp towel, so it seemed like she had been there that morning getting ready when something had happened to her. They then contacted the police, who told them that it looked like she had just gotten into her fight with her boyfriend. She probably ran away. She'll be back. And then they left.
Ran away? She's a grown woman.
Yeah. Her family said there was no way. She was not the type of person to just run away after an argument. And they eventually began to take them seriously and actually search for her in the following hours of that day. Her family called everyone that they could think of, including hospitals and jails, hoping that someone would know where she was, and no one had an answer for them. They printed out flyers and hung them around the condo and the surrounding area with her picture and a phone number to call if she's seen anywhere. Logan, her brother, actually started knocking on every door in the complex to ask anyone who would answer if they had seen or heard anything, to no avail. They even had family and friends standing on street corners passing out flyers and trying to draw more attention to as many people as possible. And this was all in the same day.
Yeah.
So less than 24 hours. They rallied behind her very quickly, which is amazing and what you need to do. The first, 48 hours are the most vital. And they were moving fast because they really wanted to locate her before the sun went down and crucial time was passing. They thought that if we can find her before sunset, we're going to have more odds of actually finding her at all. Mm-hmm. So it's said that the area in which Jennifer's condo complex was located was surrounded by some dicier areas in Orlando. It was a new, nice building, but Orlando is a big city with a high crime rate, as most big cities have. There was also a ton of construction going on as they were putting up another apartment complex right next to hers, and there were constantly construction workers there. Her complex was actually leaving the gates to her complex open and unlocked, so the workers could enter whenever they needed to, which meant that pretty much anyone else could enter as well. To make matters worse, Jennifer's complex had absolutely zero security cameras, and half of the units in this complex were still unoccupied.
I was just getting ready to ask you if they had cameras.
Nope. Which makes it all the less likely that someone had seen something in regards to Jennifer. I mean, if half of the units are unoccupied, that's way less witnesses and way less people to hear anything. Jennifer was nervous about the constant comings and goings of the construction crew. Supposedly, there were even a few workers staying in the building's empty condos after work hours. And Jennifer had told her father on multiple occasions that some of the workers had catcalled her and that the sheer number of workers regularly on site made her uncomfortable, as it would probably any young woman living by herself, which also makes it even weirder that she didn't take her pepper spray with her that day.
Yeah.
If she was already kind of on edge with the things that were going on around her apartment complex.
Did she take her pepper spray to work with her?
She took it with her everywhere.
Like, so she didn't keep it in her purse. She kept it out so she could have it.
Always kept it next to her keys, so she would grab her keys and her pepper spray and never forget it. Like, she had it on her at all times. Probably because her parents got robbed at gunpoint.
Did you say they didn't find her cell phone? It was gone and her keys. But what about Travis's cell phone?
No, they did not find it. I don't think they looked for it. I'm assuming her parents Logan was the only person who knew.
But they would have found a cell phone and would have thought it was hers.
They didn't find it.
She had that with her as well. Which would indicate she had every intention to go to work and return it.
Yes. So we are going to take a quick break here before we get into the investigation into Jennifer's disappearance.
All right. Be right back.
So by 9 p.m. that night, they still had not located her, and she was officially entered into the system as a missing person at this time, and the media started reporting on her case. She seemed to have vanished into thin air. There was no sign of her, there were no clues whatsoever, and people really had no idea where she was. Finally, on Thursday the 26th, so just 2 days later, a call came into the police station at 8:06 a.m., from a resident of Huntington on the Green, which was another apartment complex, reporting that they had located Jennifer's car less than a mile away from her condo. This specific area and complex that her car was located at was known for some drug activity, which is important to keep in mind, although Jennifer wasn't known to partake in drugs of any kind. The police asked Rob to come assess the car to see if anything seemed unusual or off to him, because he would be the one who was in it the most often with her. And when he arrived, he noticed that the front seat seemed to have been moved way farther back than Jennifer would have set it to drive herself. He said that when he drives her car, of course, he moves her seat back. But if Jennifer was driving the car, it would be super close because she was tiny.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it made no sense. It looked like someone else had been driving her car. There was absolutely no sign of struggle in her car, which made things even more difficult for law enforcement to piece together what could have happened and where she could be. The inside of Jennifer's car had no sign of struggle, no blood, no identifiable fingerprints except for Jennifer's. But, according to CBS, there was one item found that bothered detectives, a DVD player. Now, that might not seem like a big deal, but the DVD player, it's 2006. If someone was going to, like, rob her or carjack her, the DVD player would have been stolen.
Right.
And it was not. When asked what that tells him, Sergeant...
We're going to take a break.
We got a cat fight.
All right. Sorry about that. The cats were living harmoniously for a second, and then they weren't. So yeah. We are back.
So Sergeant Brennan, who was one of the policemen on the scene, said to him that it didn't appear that it was a robbery. It didn't appear that it was a car theft, and it didn't appear that it was a carjacking. There were two pairs of flip-flops belonging to Jennifer in the car, as well as a car cell phone charger and a broken mail key that was hers. The only items missing from her car were those that were presumed to be with her during the time of her disappearance, such as her phone, keys, and purse. By the grace of God, this complex actually did have a few security cameras. After Orlando police located Jennifer's vehicle at Huntington on the Green, officers reviewed surveillance footage of the parking lot where it was found. The surveillance footage showed that the car had been driven into the lot, parked, and an unknown person exited the vehicle at noon on January 24th, 2006, the same day as her disappearance. Noon is less than 5 hours after the time when Jennifer would normally exit her condo to walk to her car. This unidentified person was immediately labeled a person of interest. Unfortunately, the face of the person of interest happens to be blocked in each frame from the security footage.
Oh, how does that stuff happen? I don't even get it.
A bloodhound later tracked the scent from her car, parked at Huntington, back to her condo complex, which suggests that the POI walked back to her apartment complex after dumping the car in Huntington. The footage is so grainy that they haven't even been able to confirm the gender of this person, which is incredibly frustrating that this person got so lucky as to be caught on camera, and the footage is too bad to even show any defining features. Not even that, it could have been her.
Right, I was going to say, could they tell if it was tall like her, or short like her, or taller?
No. So, rather than actually filming a full video, the cameras at this apartment complex only took rapid still images about 3 seconds apart. And somehow, there were 3 separate pictures of the person driving her car, but their face was blocked by a gate in every single one of them.
Do you think that they knew that?
No. They were walking at the normal pace. So, like, 3 seconds would pass, they'd be in front of one part of the gate, and then they would walk, and I don't think they knew that.
That's so weird.
It's frustrating as hell. Some people actually theorize that the person in the footage is a woman because it looks like whoever it is wearing a bun on the top of their head.
Was she known to wear buns?
I'm not sure. I don't think they've said. A few days later, the police actually decided to add Jennifer's ex-boyfriend, not Rob, to their list of possible suspects. Matt Sullivan, the man who stayed at her condo with her brother Logan while she was on her trip, was apparently absolutely devastated when the two of them broke up a while back. He begged her to get back with him multiple times, to which she constantly reiterated that she was not interested. Investigators discovered that Matt had gone to the Blue Martini, a bar across the street from her condo, the night she disappeared, and that he was absolutely hammered. However, Logan Kess insists that Matt was just drinking to get over some hurt feelings, and that he doesn't think he would do anything to hurt his sister.
It would make sense if he was across the street that he would have been the one knocking on the door, but we don't know because she didn't answer the door.
Right.
So he could have showed up, knocked on the door, she didn't answer, and then he came back the next morning.
Mm-hmm. When interviewed by police, it was noted that Matt was visibly upset about his breakup with Jennifer, and was even more upset that she'd just gone on a trip with her new boyfriend. He told police that he was, quote, inconsolable for weeks after they broke up. He offered to take a polygraph, but the police ultimately decided that they didn't think he had anything to do with her disappearance, which is so odd.
Right. Why would you not at least just do the polygraph to rule it out for 100?
Right, and he's offering. So do it.
Yeah.
Very few details about Matt's involvement in interrogation are known, but you'd think this would be the first person you'd press after Rob Allen, her current boyfriend's alibi, was verified, and they knew that he was hours away at the time and couldn't do anything.
And had no reason to want to hurt her.
Right. No reason whatsoever. And also the fact that he had just stayed in her condo with her brother probably brought up some of those old feelings. Stuff,
yeah.
The fact that he's staying there while she's on a trip with a new boyfriend. But also, dude, like, she had been with Rob for a little over a year at this point. Mm-hmm. Get the fuck over it. What is wrong with you?
It's time to move on.
Yeah, move on. And it's not like they were in a long-term relationship that, like, crumbled. Seems like kind of just like a short little thing that happened and he just couldn't let it go.
Unless he'd known her for a long time because he was friends and maybe he just still had, like, a massive thing for her.
Which is possible, but, like, to be still a year later drinking, belligerently drunk at the bar across from her apartment complex.
Trying to drown your sorrows, yeah.
Like, what are you doing, dude? Get
it's
it
a bit
together.
Stalkery.
Yeah, you're all young. Like, come on. Get over it. Another suspect in this case was one of Jennifer's co-workers, Johnny Campos. Jennifer had told her dad on multiple occasions that he made her uncomfortable, as he had hit on her multiple times and got angry when she turned him down. Another co-worker claims that Johnny was upset that she was in a relationship and was annoyed to hear Jennifer talking about the trip she had just gone on with her boyfriend. On the day of her disappearance, he showed up late to work and blamed it on an unverified traffic ticket. Although there were red flags with Johnny, authorities claim there's no indication that he had anything to do with her disappearance.
Did he show up after noon? I mean, that would be nice to know.
They just said he showed up late. Because it wouldn't even matter if it was afternoon. Well, she's supposed to be there by 8:39.
I know, but wasn't that when the video camera had the surveillance footage
right.
was around noon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're right. It's weird to me that all of these very good leads are, like, coming into them, and they're not really going above and beyond to, like, verify any
of them.
They're
not vetting the suspects very well.
And Jennifer must have been a coveted lady, because
everybody wanted
her. She was very pretty, and she seemed pretty awesome, so everybody was salty that she was happy in a relationship. A widely discussed theory amongst law enforcement and web sleuths is one in regards to the construction workers at her complex. As I stated earlier, due to the renovations being done, workers were constantly coming in and out of the complex, and some had even been inside her individual unit to make repairs. Jennifer's friends told reporters that she was uncomfortable with the constant presence of an all-male crew at her home, but the police once again found no evidence that any of the workers had anything to do with her going missing. It probably would have helped if there was any form of security camera on the property to verify this, but there wasn't. Her family has suggested for a while that the construction crew had something to do with her disappearance, not only because of Jennifer's discomfort, but also because the bloodhounds tracked her scent from her car, found parked only a mile away, to bushes just outside of her condo building.
That's weird. Yeah.
Yeah. And it being only a mile away, I mean, that's very close for someone working there to that's like 5 minutes.
Back.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You're going to drive there and then be back immediately, and no one's really going to know that you're gone. Even though this gave investigators some sort of lead, they were only able to interview around 100 of the workers. There were a lot of them.
I was going to say, that's a lot of workers they talked to 100.
Apparently there were a lot of them, and they couldn't get to them all, so they just kind of did what they could do. Which is also crazy that there are that many people working on one apartment complex.
Those apartment complexes in Florida tend to be really massive and have multiple buildings, so they were probably...
What was the second building to her complex?
And you have lots of people with different skill sets, too. You have your drywallers and your plumbing people mm-hmm. and electricians, so you do need a lot. There were probably 4 and 5 people working on any room at any time.
Yeah. Sergeant Barbara Jones of the Orlando Police Department stated, "What the bloodhounds found was a scent that was picked up from the car that went back to her condominium. What we did was that we created a 3 to 5 mile radius around that track. We've done numerous grid searches in wooded, isolated areas where, if somebody was trying to hide something related to this case, we would be able to find it in those particular areas." And they found nothing. In 2009, so a couple years later, convicted murderer David Byron Russ met with Drew Kess, Jennifer's father, after claiming that he had a possible tip. According to Drew, David told him that he was playing cards with a deck that featured information about the disappearance and realized he might have information regarding the case.
Wait, there's missing persons cards?
I'm not sure. Like, this is still so...
That's so weird.
Weird to me. Like, I was trying to read more from, like, multiple places that would go in depth about this, but I'm like, the first thing that came to mind was, like, he was, like, playing with tarot cards and had, like...
No, I don't think that's...
No, he was just playing cards, so I don't know if, like, maybe someone in...
Maybe someone in the family paid to have her picture put on some cards to try and, like, get the information out. I've never seen those, but that, I mean, it's kind of a cool idea.
Yeah. It was weird that it would fall into the hands of a convicted murderer, killer. But... Drew passed this information to law enforcement, but the police said that they had no plans to meet with David because all of the information he provided was already known by the public. Due to this still being an ongoing case, what exactly was shared between the two is not currently public knowledge. In December 2018, the Kess family filed a lawsuit against the Orlando Police Department to get their hands on the unredacted police files. The Kesses claim that in the decades since the investigation began, no real leads have come from authorities. The family and authorities reached an agreement in March of 2019 for them to gain access to all records from the case, including video and audio recordings. So they are finally to the point where they're like, nothing's coming from what you're doing. Give us everything you have and we will do the investigation on our own because you're not helping at all. In 2018, the family also created a GoFundMe to get financial help to conduct their own investigation, but I read that they were, like, denied private investigators, like, time and time again. Like, no one wanted to work with them.
I wonder why.
Like, they were unable to hire a private investigator. Which is so...
Did they just not think they had anything enough to go on?
I don't know. But it's weird, because usually private investigators are, like, ready to go with anything.
Yeah.
And they get the job done.
I would definitely go PI route at this point, but if no one will take it, that's weird.
I know. And just sad. Really sad. Of course, as with most missing persons cases, especially those involving young women, a huge theory is that of human trafficking. Given the fact that Jennifer had gone missing, and only Jennifer had gone missing, and none of her belongings were touched, it may be possible that this is the case. It didn't look like a robbing or, like, anything like that. Mm-hmm. Like, no one broke into her apartment. All of her stuff was still there.
No forced entry.
Car wasn't stolen. Like, they found her car. Also, whoever, like, did have her car, if it wasn't her, what an idiot. Why would you park it only a mile away?
Yeah, but, I mean, they weren't that much of an idiot because they didn't leave any prints behind or anything like that. Yeah,
and her dad also thinks that the car was, like, had to have been wiped down.
Yeah.
Like, it had to have been thoroughly wiped down before they got out of it because if it's not her driving and her prints are the only ones found, then what the hell did you do? You wear gloves?
You would think that they would have moved the seat back, but maybe they were just ready to...
construction gloves?
And they've never found her body. Mm-mm. And if the car only moved a mile away, and that's where it's dumped, you would think they would have found her body in close proximity.
Right.
If there were a body to find, which would make me think there isn't.
Yeah, I would agree. So for years, Orlando has ranked third in the nation for the highest rates of human trafficking. It's a major tourist destination with Disney right around the corner, and millions of travelers visit the city annually, so you got a lot of different people coming in and out of that place. All kinds of people, and some of whom may have had insidious intentions. That being said, with most, like, theories of, like, sex trafficking, even the one that we just discussed... Oh my gosh, I'm blanking on her name. Amy Lynn Bradley.
Yeah.
Like, the theory, like, is kind of backed up because she's been spotted so many different times with, like, different men. There have been zero sightings of Jennifer since her disappearance. None. So unless someone, like, came in from somewhere far away and took her back to where they're from, like, I don't know.
Could it be somebody spotted her on their trip and decided they wanted to follow them and came back and took her away? I mean, Orlando, I think there's lots of travel that happens by various means out of Orlando, so, I mean...
I mean, and also the fact that she was such a habitual, routine person, she would have been very easy to, like...
Follow.
She took the same route every day. She did everything the same way, same route there, same route back, which...
For those of you listening, you're especially supposed to not ladies, do that. Especially
ladies, do not do that. Change it up every now and then, because if someone's watching, they will know.
Even if you just take, like, a 2-minute drive around somewhere instead of going immediately from work to home, and every once in a while I'll take a different way home because there's several ways to get to our house, especially when I worked nights. I always did that. I would take one way home one night and another way home another night, and if I ever thought somebody was by me, I would always make it a point to drive by the police station before I went home. Yeah. So,
and I'm such a paranoid person too. I leave work really late and early in the mornings and no one's out and about. I'm literally constantly checking in my rearview mirror to make sure that no one, like, watched me pull out of my work parking lot. Because they're going to see me, a 23-year-old woman, leaving a bar by herself, presumably with money on her.
Yeah.
Get her car and drive straight out.
Yeah.
And our street, like, the street that I work on is, it fucking closes down at, like, 9 p.m., it feels like, and there's no, like, street lights or anything, so that'd be...
I mean, it's
prime kidnapping territory.
Definitely, you gotta keep your head on a swivel.
Just stay vigilant, which, you know, the thing that sucks is I feel like she was a very vigilant person, like, given what her parents have said, she tried to protect herself and do everything right, essentially, like, calling people, which is also a great idea. Like, if you're walking literally just from, like, I would do that all the time with you, like, when I lived in New Orleans, if I'm, like, just walking from work to my apartment complex that is 5 minutes away, I'm calling you.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are going to see you on the phone, which is going to be a deterrent, but even if it's not a deterrent, you're going to have someone on the phone who hears everything that goes on.
They actually did a study, because you know how the old thing used to be, keep your keys in your hand so you can, like, stab somebody with it, and they actually asked people who had committed crimes what was a bigger deterrent, seeing somebody with their keys in their hand, were they worried about getting stabbed? And they're like, no, but if I ever saw somebody on a cell phone, I didn't bother them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't want anybody to be able to hear anything that would connect them to it. So yeah,
exactly.
Even if you're
especially
not even
you
talking
just hear
to somebody,
someone's voice.
You just hold it up to your ear and make it look like you are.
Yeah, they even say that, like, if you're in an Uber that's kind of sketchy and, like, you feel like you might be getting napped a little bit, like someone has some nefarious intentions, make a phone call.
Yeah.
Because if they hear that you're on the phone,
they're going to leave you alone. Yeah.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, not always, because there are some times where they don't, but it will be a deterrent at least. So Jennifer Kess is still missing to this day, and her family is still looking for her. At the time of her disappearance, she was 24 years old, 5'7" tall, 130 pounds with sandy blonde hair and green eyes. She is a white woman with a tattoo of a shamrock on her left butt cheek. And in 2022, Jennifer would be around 40 years old.
Yeah, I was going to say, she's pretty close to my age.
This is still an open case, and as I said with the last one, if you or anyone you know has any information or tips that could lead to locating Jennifer Joyce Kess, please contact your local FBI office or submit an anonymous tip online at FBI.gov. Just this year, her father wrote on social media, which is just so heartbreaking. He said, January 24th, 2022 will mark the start of the 17th year we have desperately been trying to find our loved one, Jennifer Kess. We will not stop until we have found her and bring her home where she belongs, even if it's DNA. Our love for Jennifer is greater than this universe, and Jennifer knows it. Jennifer, we love you.
Oh, that's so sad.
He has also recently openly criticized the Orlando Police Department, stating, almost 4 years ago, we came to an agreement with the Orlando Police Department that they would, over the period of 4 months, generate a digital file of Jennifer's case and give it to us as their, at their requested cost of $18,000. We paid the price in full up front. That four-month agreement has turned into 3 years and 10 months, and the department is still incapable of fulfilling their end of the agreement. Incompetency at its best. If we did that, we'd be in jail. Now imagine, over that time, fighting for unredacted copies with the city's lawyers and trying to have our private investigators find Jennifer from all those files, which is probably why people were like, we can't take this case on because we have nothing to work from. Then finding out that the lead detective on Jennifer's case did not write a single report or any document since 2010. 12 years. Nothing written is nothing investigated.
Yeah, that would be the most frustrating thing ever. All of these cases are so frustrating for the families. Mm-hmm. And I know that you're going to be upset and frustrated anyway, but I would think it would appease your mind a little bit knowing that someone else was fighting just as hard as you to try and find your
right
loved one. And I get it. The cops have lots of cases. They can't just focus on one. They have to try. There's, sadly, we have a crime problem in the United States, and there are lots of missing people at any given point in time, and it's unreasonable to expect someone to 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, work solely on your case. But for the few hours you are working and the few days you are, give it your best,
mm-hmm,
and let everybody know that that's what's happening.
And when you're given all of these leads, investigate them to the fullest extent.
Yeah.
Like, don't just be like, oh, we don't think there's any possible way that person could have anything to do with this, and then just forget everything that that person did. Like, investigate it to the fullest extent. When you then realize that there's no way that that person can do it, then stop and move on to the next one.
Right.
Don't just talk to someone for 2 hours and then be like, oh, you're fine.
Do we know if, like, the other people that were investigated, if they went on to, like, live normal lives, or... Well, sometimes somebody's behavior after a crime happens is also a really good indication on whether or not they were involved.
Like, so guilt, and Logan, her brother, and Matt Sullivan, her ex-boyfriend, have been interviewed recently, and Logan says that his friend group was like, actually, absolutely like, wrong, taken through the ringer, essentially the media ringer. A lot of people, like on, I'm assuming like Nancy Grace type people, implied that Logan had something to do with it, and like. He said that it, like, ruined their friend group for a long time because he's like, I don't want to be seen, like, associating with my friend who the public thinks murdered my sister. And Matt has said, still to this day, said that he has nothing to do with it, that he was just a scorned young boy who was just salty, essentially.
Well, and honestly, there's no evidence of a murder.
No, there's none at all.
There was no blood, no blood in the trunk.
No blood in her apartment. No blood in her apartment. Nothing.
I mean, it seems more like a kidnapping than a murder.
Mm-hmm.
But that also, I don't know. There's so many cameras, like you said earlier when you were talking, like, there are so many toll cameras in Florida. You have to drive on toll roads all the time. Mm-hmm. It's really annoying. Cost a fortune to drive there. You would think that, well, I guess, though, in a small residential area, you're not really going from toll to toll.
No.
There would be
no
reason.
But if they were,
to.
Like, leaving Orlando also, they wouldn't know who to look for because they're not looking for a car anymore. Like, they found her car, so now they don't even know what car to look for if someone did actually, like, kidnap her. Put them in their own car, her
and then just
car.
Drive her car and dispose of it.
Yeah, like they would have no idea what to look for.
Yeah, it's, the whole thing is really strange.
Yeah, and her dad, Drew, actually said that the human trafficking theory like didn't even cross his mind for a really long time until he like saw people on the internet talking about it, and he was like, "Well, actually, that might be a big possibility because she's the only thing missing. Mm-hmm. Nothing else is missing. Like, obviously, no one broke into her apartment to like rob her, or steal her money,
take 2 cell phones,
right?" Yeah.
It's a really sad story.
I did read that in her car they found like one like latent handprint, but it was like looked like it could have been hers, but also it was like so like fucked up that they couldn't like do anything with it. So in the event that it was someone else's handprint, they wouldn't be able to know.
Yeah. And we talked about this before. Fingerprints are only worth something if the person has a record, or if you're taking them seriously as a suspect and you match the fingerprints with something else, which
the one thing that sticks with me is the fact that her clothes were laid out on her bed, which implies to me that she left like not in work clothes. Her mom said that it was like something that she would definitely wear to work. It was like her cute little business casual outfit and these new boots that she was like really excited to wear that were obviously like matching the outfit that she was going to wear. All of that was laid out on her bed.
So she didn't even get dressed.
So, like, she took her shower. Her shower was still wet. And there was a damp towel. Clear that she was, like, getting ready to go to work. But she was not dressed for work.
I mean, is it possible she just ran away? It sounds unlikely, but people do stuff like that sometimes.
Well, I also, like, almost wonder, back to, like, Matt, even though there's, like, don't sue me. I mean, I'm not blaming him on anything. But say he did show up that morning, like, knocked on the door and was like, can we just talk for a little bit? And she, like, wasn't dressed for work and, like, went out to the parking lot and talked to him for a little bit, and then God knows what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Or just, like, anything like that. Because the whole...
Or she went out and talked to him, and then when she was going back in, somebody else did something to her.
Because the whole, like, outfit on the bed and then pepper spray still there implies to me that she left fast. She wasn't dressed, and she didn't take the one thing that she took with her every
or
day.
Or she left with someone that she wasn't worried about hurting her.
I feel like she still would have taken that.
Not if she was planning on going back in and getting dressed and going to work.
Maybe.
That would be but why take both the cell phones? Mm-hmm. I could see her taking her cell phone.
Yeah.
But not both of them.
Yeah, it's almost like Travis, like,
grabbed whatever they saw that they thought, yeah, that doesn't make any sense. This one's perplexing. Not that I'm some kind of, like, a sleuth that can figure things out, but...
Well, what do you think is the most, like, possible theory?
I would probably go with the kidnapping and sex trafficking thing.
I feel like the whole construction worker thing is just the most obvious to me. When you have that many people who... I mean, a lot of times they hire, like, out-of-state people to come do shit like that. So it could be people who aren't even from the area.
Yeah, and it could
that are hired on for a couple days to work a project, saw her by herself. I mean, she's in an apartment complex that's only half occupied. They know there's not a lot of people there.
Mm-hmm.
And the... room right across from her was unoccupied and unlocked at all times. They said that they confirmed that no one had been living there, staying there, like whatever, but the room right across from her, and bloodhounds went to that room and didn't have like a trace of her scent or anything, but
Somebody else could have been in there.
Right. The one right across from her was unoccupied and unlocked. It's weird to me also that, I mean, I guess since they had construction workers, but you'd think that, like, a really nice, because this was a really nice, brand new condo complex, they would not want to keep the doors unlocked to unoccupied units in a city as big as Orlando.
No.
Where people could just, like, know that that place is open all the time and come squat in their building.
Especially with it being close to areas that were known for prolific drug use. Yeah. You don't want a bunch of people doing drugs in your complex, because who's going to want to live there?
Mm-hmm.
No one's going to want to be looking at an apartment in a nice complex that's full of people.
Yeah, like, just the fact that they even acknowledged or knew that the apartment complex that her place was found at was known for drug activity, like, word gets around, yeah. And people are going to know, okay, this complex is known for this, this complex is known for that, and then you're going to have no one moving into your brand new, yeah, expensive-ass condominium place.
I feel like the community, the condo people could be culpable for not maintaining,
yeah, and you'd also
safety.
Think that, yeah, why are there no security cameras at your brand new place?
Maybe they hadn't gotten around to putting them up yet.
I don't know. It's just like, there, I have so many questions. Things like this are so frustrating because, I mean, hindsight's 20/20, but looking back, so many things that could have been done prior to her disappearing that would have made finding her so much easier.
For sure. Gosh, every time. All right, well, next week, when we come back, I think I'm going to do cursed objects, so that'll be not quite as heavy, although it's kind of scary.
So. Yeah.
Very scary stuff. In the meantime, hopefully we don't have any more creepy stuff happening around here, because I swear I kept hearing somebody sneezing last night.
It was probably me.
You weren't home.
Oh,
you were at work. I'm telling you, our house is going off right now. I don't know what's happening.
Well, if any, all of you guys listening, if you have, like, your own theories or theories that you think are more likely than others, please, like, leave them in our comments, because I'd love to know what you think. Like, the fact that there are so many, there's four separate theories that could have happened, mm-hmm, and any of them could have been true. Literally anyone.
Or none of them. Or something that they haven't even thought of. Yeah, there's lots of things it could be. All right, well, thank you for listening again to the Monsters and Mixers podcast. We're really happy if you've made it a whole year with us. If you're new, we're happy also.
Yeah.
Stay with us
for a year.
Yeah. So we plan on doing this for many years. We're very excited. Please make sure you follow us on our socials. We have Facebook at Monsters and Mixers Pod, Twitter at Monsters Mixers, and Instagram at Monsters and Mixers Podcast.
Like and follow us on your preferred listening platform, leave a 5-star rating, and send us those stories via email at monstersandmixers2@gmail.com or at one of the socials mentioned.
See you next time when we dive into another terrifying tale and concoct a new delicious drink to wash down the horror. Now get out there and meet some ghosts.
And make some toasts.